Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you each and every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and KMJ580.com on the internet worldwide. Got an exciting program for you today with a Valley veteran of World War II. In fact, he's a veteran who's been featured in that book that you might own, and if you don't, maybe you should. That book, Stories of Service, Valley Veterans Remember World War II, by Janice Stevens, who compiled a lot of these stories in the class that she has every Monday in Clovis. We might talk about that class a little bit later on. And Bob Owens is featured in that book. He was featured on TV a couple of years ago when I was doing those stories there, and I'm very pleased to have him on the show today. Bob, you're wearing your Sanger Apache Red today, I guess, huh?
Oh, that's right. Here for the Apaches.
Now, you grew up in Sanger. That's why I make the Apache reference there. And I like to ask every veteran to start off with about Pearl Harbor, what they remember about that day, where were you, and how'd you find out about the attack on December 7th, 1941?
Well, I can tell you exactly where I was. A friend of mine and I went to a dance on Saturday night at Rainbow Ballroom, and I stayed all night out at his house, which was out on Academy Avenue. So the next morning, we were up, and we went out in the vineyard and were shooting rabbits. And we got back to the house about 12:15, and his mother was standing there with tears down her eyes. And she told us that the Japanese had just bombed Pearl Harbor, and us boys were going to have to go to war. And she didn't like that.
She had it all figured out already?
She had it figured out right down to the thing.
Had you ever heard of Pearl Harbor before?
Not really, no.
And did it sink in right there and then that what she was saying was probably going to be true for you?
Absolutely, yeah. And, of course, we all wanted to get in. And being at high school, the day that the president gave his speech declaring war, it was an amazing thing. The Japanese children in the school that were seniors were given their diplomas and they were gone. It just happened that quick. Mm. And as everybody knows, and everybody was taken out at the school at that time.
Well, in last week's program dealt with the Japanese internment and the upcoming ceremonies. In fact, tonight is that showing I told you about last week with American Pastime, the fine film. Kerio Nakagawa will be there answering questions tonight at the Clovis Veterans Memorial Building, a place Bob Owens knows very well. That free screening is at 7 o'clock tonight, and don't forget the dedication of Remembrance Plaza, the Pinedale Assembly Center Memorial. That is Monday morning from 10 a.m. to noon. And so you saw the effects of that right there in your hometown. How long was it before you ended up working for Uncle Sam in the U.S. Navy?
It was until 1943.
And it was your idea?
Yeah. Well, the draft was starting to breathe down my neck, so I figured I didn't really want to go out and march around in the mud, so I thought I would join the Navy, and I come to Fresno, and that's what I did.
And you join the Navy, so they're going to send you someplace nice and tropical around the ocean breeze, and you go out on a ship, and they send you to Farragut, Idaho.
Right, in February. And I remember distinctly the train started, I think, in Los Angeles and picked up recruits all the way up the coast. We got to this town in Idaho by the base. I stepped off the train, slipped on the ice, and fell flat on my back. I thought, what a great place this is going to be.
They don't teach you how to walk on the ice in Sanger,
no,
do they?
Not a bit.
That sounds exactly like my first year of college in upstate New York, only I think I did it about 10 times. So you had to get used to the weather there in a hurry. And did you start to get a feel for the kinds of things you wanted to be involved in the Navy, or did they make those choices for you?
Well, right at first in boot camp is basically getting your clothes, your haircut, and all your shots together, and learning how to march and things like that. And then you are given tests, and based on that, they give you sort of options like, well, you could be a signalman or you could be a torpedoman. And I said I wanted to be an electrician because I figured there was no electrical school, I'd get out of Farragut. No, they started an electrical school in Farragut, and there I was.
The best laid plans. Yeah, that didn't exactly work out. So you had to stay in Farragut in the new electrician school. And I know you got done with that in September of 1943. And then they were looking for volunteers?
Yeah, they come in, the chief come in and said, we need 5 volunteers for submarine school. Well, I don't know why, I held my hand up. And
that is, I've been told by so many veterans, when you're in the military, never volunteer for anything.
That's true, and it still holds true. But I held my hand up because I was trying to get out of Farragut, to be honest. What did I do? I went to New London. It was just as cold as it was in Farragut.
Across the country for more cold weather.
Right.
That's New London, Connecticut.
Correct.
And so you start to learn about these things called submarines. And I think people today have this idea of submarines, and maybe they've read Tom Clancy books or they've seen Hunt for Red October or one of those submarine movies. Those submarines are a completely different animal from the submarines that you're dealing with. Explain to our listeners what you were starting to understand at that time about how exactly these submarines worked and how advanced or maybe lack thereof those submarines were.
Well, the first submarine I ever went to sea on was an O-boat. That was the class, built during World War I. It was an all-riveted hull, and we took it out into Long Island Sound and dove. And we'd go down about 50 feet, and the thing leaked like a sieve. And but, you know, we were young. We didn't know the difference. And then we progressed from that into the next class, which was an S boat, a little bit bigger, not any nicer inside. And then we finally got to, they had some old fleet boats back there, which were the big 312-foot-long submarines that were welded and were a lot more room. There again, though, you had only about 18 feet inside. It was round, and it was 300 feet long, the living spaces. But then you think about it, inside that space, you had to put all the machinery and the pipes and everything. So it was very close quarters. But the old boat, the first one, they were really something again. If you could survive those, I guess you could survive any. It was kind of heart-rending the first time you dove. And they were all hand-operated flood valves. They had a large lever, like a, if you've ever seen the brakeman on a San Francisco cable car, that big brake. That's what they, a brake like that. Well, I wasn't strong enough to open the one I was assigned, and this crew member helped me. Well, it rode up over the eccentric of this thing, and then I fell all the way clear across the boat because it was...
Times have changed, huh?
Really changed. And now the big nukes, like the big Trident submarines, you could put probably 3 of those O-boats inside of one of those.
Yeah, the claustrophobia isn't quite the same as it was in your day. And you have plenty of experience with newer submarines, too, which we're going to touch on a little bit later on. But I think the thing that surprises most people when they first hear about World War II submarines, if they weren't familiar with them before, those submarines, including the one that you would serve on during the war, they had to surface every single day to charge the batteries or else you're toast.
That is correct. With the full battery charge, we could probably stay submerged for 36 hours and still have enough power to get up to the surface and start the engines. But
you don't want to push it, though.
You don't want to do that if you don't have to.
Because there's no way out. If you're going down, you're dead.
If you're down and you run out of juice, you're in trouble. You can blow the tanks and maybe get up, but you haven't got anything to do with.
Exactly. Well, there are still some World War II submarines on display around the country. I know my friend Joe Cox in Las Banas goes back to see his in Oklahoma, where it's on display every once in a while. I was in Hawaii last week for a basketball game, and they have the USS Bowfin on display next to Pearl Harbor. The Bowfin was actually assigned to some of the same tasks that you were in World War II. We're going to talk about that. Right now, we need to take our first commercial break. We're going to come back more with World War II submarine veteran Bob Owens today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you are listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Attention with that one, didn't we? That, of course, Anchors Away, performed by the local Sounds of Freedom band. Our good friends with the band like playing their music here on the program, and I've heard from a lot of you who enjoy hearing it, so I'll keep playing it. Our guest today is a Navy veteran of World War II and beyond. Bob Owens joins us in World War II. You heard him describe how he had volunteered for submarine duty, started sub school in September of 1943, graduated almost at the end of that year, just before the new year, and I understand, Bob, you were assigned to a submarine relief crew on board the subtender USS Bushnell. So not quite on a submarine yet. You're just trying to help the guys who are on submarines? Is that what it amounts to?
Well, what I was assigned to, what we called a relief crew. When the submarine came in off patrol, the crew would be taken off right away and sent out to the Royal Hawaiian Theater for a couple of weeks, and the relief crew would go down and we would clean the boat up, do any painting, do any repair work. So we were learning the submarine at the same time we were getting it ready for the crew to take it out again. So I did that on the Bushnell, and then we took the Bushnell out to Majuro Atoll and set up an advanced submarine repair facility. And that was from there, then I was transferred to the USS Tenosa, the submarine, on my 20th birthday, June the 3rd, 1944.
Nice birthday,
yeah.
What did that feel like at the time? Is that something that you had been looking forward to, or maybe a little apprehensive about? What was your reaction?
No, I was just tickled pink to get to go. What happened was, the Bureau of Personnel sent a letter or something, told all the submarines to take an extra electrician over allowance for training. Well, my name just happened to be the next one on the list. Two of the guys below me that went out on the next submarine were lost, so I lucked out there. But I was really looking forward to getting on a boat because that's what I wanted to do, and that's what I was trained to do.
And that was something I'm sure that you pieced together after the fact, after you heard about the other sub
right.
going down. And a lot of people aren't aware of the heavy price that the submarine service, the silent service, as those who have served undersea know it, that the heavy price that submariners paid for the United States in the World War II effort. How often do you think about that, and is there something that kind of reminds you about all the guys who gave their lives for our country doing exactly the kind of things that you were doing?
Well, it comes to mind to me a lot, particularly if I'm reading a submarine story or I hear something on the news about a submarine doing something, because it was a very close-knit organization. And if a boat went down, you probably knew at least one person on that. If, say, I would know another electrician, but it comes to mind a lot, really.
And there were 52 American submarines that were sunk during World
Correct.
War II.
We lost, I think it was over 3,500 officers and men down. And when you consider we had 1.6% of the Navy personnel, we had a very high casualty rate.
Well, and you also inflicted some pretty heavy damages, especially in the theater where you were operating in the Pacific against the Japanese. There were a lot of Japanese ships that were taken out by the submarine force.
Right. The submarine force was credited at the end of things, sank over 56% of all the merchant shipping. And I forget the percentage of military ships, but we got a lot of those also.
So you were aboard the Tenosa, and you're the electrician on board. What's day-to-day life like for you? Is it fairly monotonous, or was it a little more eventful than you wanted it to be?
No, if you're just on patrol, it gets kind of monotonous, but electricians always have something to do, because when you're messing with seawater and electrical stuff like batteries and so forth, there's always something going on. And the electrical gang was sort of split, and we had one group that handled, you referred to it as the auxiliaries. That was all the little motors and generators and things like that. And then you had the main power guys. They handled the batteries and the generators and the main motors and ran the controllers and stuff.
Was it your biggest fear? Did you ever wake up in the middle of the night with a nightmare that there was some electrical issue on the ship, on the submarine, that you just couldn't figure out and couldn't fix?
No, not really. The guys we had were pretty talented. Our old chief electrician, he had actually retired from submarines before the war started and was called back. So he knew submarines fantastic. He was great, and he was a great teacher.
Wow, that's invaluable.
Yes, it was.
The answer man.
Yeah.
Now, I know that you had some close calls, and you were involved in seven different patrols with the Tenosa.
Correct.
In the Pacific. I know you told me about one when we did a story on TV, the south end of the Sea of Japan, where you're with a group of other submarines, mm-hmm. Hellcats.
Yes.
And you had to navigate through a minefield. How do you do that?
Well, what they did, they've come up with FM sonar. They called it a QLA. It was the designator. It was a mine detection sonar. It was good for about 400 yards. And there were nine of us went into the Sea of Japan through the south end. And we all went in, and we all got in safely. We plotted, I think it was about four rows of mines. The Japanese set them at about 70 feet deep, so their surface ships could run over the top of them, but submarine might hit them. We did have one mine cable scrape down the side of the ship, and
did that take your breath away?
It took more of your breath away. My watch station was in maneuvering room, which is the next to the last compartment, so I could hear that thing coming the 300 feet down the side of that ship.
Are you just bracing for an explosion at that point?
Well, that's all you could do. They closed all the watertight doors and so forth, but that wouldn't do any good.
Not going to help you a whole lot. Say a little prayer, right. Cross your fingers. I bet that seemed like it lasted forever, too. Huh?
It did. Well, we're only going about, three knots, and that's not very fast. That's about 4 miles an hour at the most. Just barely going, and it took a long time for that cable to get clear.
And where you were, you heard it come basically right over the top of you?
Right down alongside.
Uh-huh.
And so it scraped a good 300 feet down the side of that ship.
That's a close enough call for you, huh?
Yeah, that's close enough to mines for me.
And while this is all going on, did you guys aboard ship, aboard the Tenosa, did you have an idea of how many other submarines had been lost and how dangerous the work that you were undertaking really was?
Well, we know for a fact there were two submarines lost to mines. There were some other ones that had been lost that they're not sure, but they had an idea they hit mines. So it was a pretty dangerous job, really. And the reason they sent us in there, because there weren't any ships out in the rest of the Pacific to sink. And the only ships the Japanese had left were up in the Sea of Japan. So that's why they sent us in there.
And that meant if you could cut them off, you were providing a pretty valuable service to the overall effort in the Pacific.
Right. And part of the reason was, the idea was a psychological one. They tried to get the point across to the Japanese civilians that, hey, you can't go anyplace. We can go. You can't hide. We got you covered.
And your crew, while you were on the Tenosa, was able to sink four Japanese freighters. Do I have that right?
Yeah, we sank four ships up in the Sea of Japan.
What, when something like that happened, Was there celebration on board? Was it more, well, that's just our job, we're not going to get too excited because we could be the next one to go down?
No, we were pretty happy about doing it.
Yeah.
Because that was our job. And, of course, that the more ships you sunk, the more fame you got, you might say. And we were all going for all we could get.
And what was the method of tabulating those? You know, you see a PT boat in the Mediterranean and they've got swastikas on the hull or whatever, or airplanes, they've got the rising suns to catalog all their kills on the side of the American fighters. How did you guys keep track of that?
Well, we made a flag. It was white with a big red circle in the middle, Japanese flag, really.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd hang that from the periscope when we came in. And the Tenosa overall sank 16 merchant ships. And, in fact, our 5-inch cannon even had a flag. We sank one with the 5-inch cannon. So we had a flag hanging on the cannon.
Oh, man.
But that was the way we indicated how well we had done.
Any other close calls during the war that kind of stand out in your mind, or some of those other ones that woke you up?
In the Sea of Japan, again, we launched the torpedoes, three torpedoes at a freighter, and we had what is referred to as a circular run. In other words, the torpedo goes out towards the target, and due to malfunction, turns around and comes back. Actually, it's running in circles. And one of ours, in fact, it was out of tube 8, decided to come back. And here again, everybody gets pretty tense. In fact, the captain ordered the boat to go to 700 feet, and our test depth was 300. But anyway, it passed right over the top of the ship.
Now, this is a torpedo that you fired.
That we fired.
But is about to come back and blow you out of the water.
Came back. And we know of two of our submarines that were actually sunk by their own torpedoes. The Tang and the Tullaby were both sunk from circular run torpedoes. And it's bad enough when the other guy's shooting at you, but
I can imagine the ship at that point, either you're all yelling and screaming or you're all just ghostly white and silent.
It's dead silence.
Mm-hmm.
And you can hear this thing coming because it's a high-pitched whine from the propellers. And it's traveling about 35 miles an hour, so it doesn't take long to cover half a mile.
And how much do you think it missed you by?
Well, we were, by the time it got to us, we probably were down 150 feet. But you didn't know whether the depth mechanism was screwed up like the steering mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
It probably went over us at about depth of 10 feet. I think it was set to run at 10 feet, and I think that's what it was. But it's a pretty hairy sound when it goes there.
Any reaction, any unified sigh of relief or anything that went up around you when you realized it had gone past you?
Oh, yeah, there was a lot of relief.
I can only imagine. Well, on that note, we need to take another commercial break here. When we come back, we'll finish up the rest of World War II with Bob Owens as far as how he experienced it. And his story with the U.S. Navy does not stop there. It's a remarkable story. You've heard how he entered the Navy as an enlisted man. Wait till you hear where he ended up in the Navy before he retired. We'll get that story when we come back to Hometown Heroes. You're listening to News Talk 580 KMJ. Hey,
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. About halfway through the program today, it always goes by way too fast for my taste anyway. We're joined today by Bob Owens, grew up in Sanger. You've heard him describe how he ended up in the Silent Service, serving on submarines during World War II. The USS Tenosa, in particular, in the Pacific, described some of those close calls from a mine cable to their own torpedo that almost took them out. And another thing that really, I guess, gives you perspective, Bob, you're confronted so often with the gravity of war, the finality that becomes a reality for so many Americans who served. 400,000 Americans gave their lives for our country during World War II. And one of the duties of submarines during the war that you don't hear a whole lot about was they were often called upon to pick up airmen who had been shot down. I know that your crew at one point picked up close to a dozen gentlemen who had been shot down in their B-29s. And there was another circumstance where you came across a raft and wished you had been there about 2 or 3 days earlier.
Yeah, what it was, we were up in the East China Sea, and on the surface, we picked up a U.S. Navy life raft, one of the yellow rubber life rafts. In the life raft, we found the body of a young sailor who had been an air crew in a shot-down airplane. We recovered the body, and then looking it over, we found his wallet. And in the young man's wallet, he had written a diary of sort and talked to his girlfriend. Her nickname was Big Eyes. I'll never forget that. Sure. Anyway, it was a very heart-rendering thing. Three of them got out of the airplane, the pilot, the gunner, and this boy was a radio operator. The pilot died first, so he was buried, and the second guy passed away, and he buried him. And then the raft was strafed by a Japanese plane, and this young man was shot in both legs. Mm. And his diary describes like he caught a fish on one day, and that kind of made his whole day. But we got to him 3 days too late. And so we searched everything, make sure we had all identification, had his ring, and then we gave him a good Navy Christian burial at sea. And the captain wrote to his family and enclosed the ring in the diary. And we got a nice letter back from his parents thanking us for at least doing that much for their son. It made us all pretty, well, it could happen to anybody, but at least we were happy we could do that for that young man.
Well, and I'm sure that's what you would want done for you if you were that young man. It kind of reminds you can't take anything for granted. What an emotional journey that must have been for you and the entire crew at that point. And I know it. You know, a lot of guys, you hear them talk and you think maybe they became numb to it after a while, that the death and destruction is just, it goes with the territory, it's going to happen. I can tell right now this still touches you. It's still real for you.
Yes, it is. I don't think, well, I think you like to try to be hard and tough, but when something like that happens, it sticks with you. You just know that you're pretty mortal.
No doubt about it. The good Lord was looking out for you. Now, so you got to the Pacific in 1944, and by August of 1945, the war was coming to an end. Do you remember where you were and how you heard about VJ Day, that this was finally over?
Yes, I do. We'd been back from the Royal Hawaiian from our trip into the Sea of Japan. We were loaded up for our next patrol. And the first rumor of the war over came out, and I remember the big celebration we had on the piers at Pearl Harbor, and guys were shooting guns and hollering and screaming, but it was a rumor. And the big shots came down and said, hey, you guys get underway. So the next morning we got underway for our 12th patrol, and about halfway to Midway, where we were going to refuel, the war was officially over. We had orders, we went to Midway, we topped off our fuel, got underway, and went as fast as we could to Mare Island, California to decommission the Tenosa.
Couldn't get there fast enough.
No. We didn't even, we made one last dive outside the Golden Gate just for fun, and then that was it.
Now, is that the origin of that picture that I've seen you share with me and that I know you saw blown up somewhere else, a large exposure of it, where you and other submarines are coming in with flags all over the deck?
Yeah, that was coming back from the Sea of Japan.
Okay.
That's what that picture was. Yeah, I liberated that picture from the headquarters at Pearl Harbor.
Liberated. That's a good choice of words for it. And you were just telling me that you went to a reunion of your group, a convention up in Seattle, and there on the wall is this huge picture, and you're the little dot in the back of the boat.
That's the one, way back there.
So you get out of the service, you're honorably discharged in March of 1946, come back home to Sanger, and then you decided to go to Fresno State.
Yes, I did. I went got up there and took all my entrance exams. And I was very fortunate. I had to take Bonehead English, but I wasn't alone. My advisor first told me I should major in mathematics. Well, mathematics is definitely not my strong suit. And I tried to tell him this, but he didn't understand what I was saying. And he signed me up to all kinds of high-class math. And I could see right away this wasn't going to work. So I switched to geology real quick. And so my degree was in geology.
So you got your degree in 1950. And here's where the story takes an interesting turn, because you were an enlisted man in World War II, an electrician aboard submarines. And you decided, you know what, I missed the Navy a little bit. If I could go back as an officer, that would be pretty neat, especially if I can skip officer candidate school. How did you get away with that?
Well, they had a program. There was a sign over in the student union, you know, like one of these Uncle Sam wants you type. And so I went to San Francisco to the Naval District and applied for a commission in the Civil Engineer Corps of the Navy. Because with my geology degree, I knew that they sent those guys to the University of Oklahoma Petroleum School. And I figured, shoot, in 6 months, I'd be head of Standard Oil. But I took all the tests, and the commission came back line officer. That's just a general officer, could go any place. So I accepted it. I didn't have to. I took it. Then I found out I could apply for a submarine designator. So I applied for that, and that was given to me. So now I was an officer, but I was earmarked for submarines, which was what I wanted to do in the first place.
And submarines had been developing during this time.
An interesting thing, I could join the reserve here in Fresno on a non-drill pay status because they had no billets for a submarine officer.
And why would they in Fresno?
But anyway, we went to Monterey for a weekend cruise on a destroyer. They put me on watch midnight with a ship's officer, and we were right out in the traffic lanes out of San Francisco. Ships all over the place, people making reports, and I didn't know what to do. I'd never been an officer before, let alone on a surface ship. So pretty soon they called up from the engineering spaces and asked permission to blow tubes. I didn't even know what that meant. The only tubes I know were torpedo tubes. Well, we figured this out, and the chief says, well, sir, you better tell him. I said, well, where's Lieutenant so-and-so? Oh, he says, he's down in the wardroom having coffee. I said, well, Chief, you better tell him that I'm a submarine guy. I've never been on a surface ship before. And that poor guy almost fainted. But anyway, we didn't have any problems.
You made him a little nervous.
Yeah.
But it all worked out okay.
Yeah.
And you would get plenty more experience on submarines.
I got recalled. And I was in April, and I sent me back to Norfolk, Virginia. There again is a funny thing. I got to set orders, and it didn't say where the Sirago was. That was the name of the submarine. It said the port in which it may be at the time you report. Well, that made a lot of sense.
Good luck finding that.
I called San Francisco, and they said, oh, yeah, we got a copy of those orders. I said, well, where's the Sirago? And this yeoman I was talking to says, I can't tell you, that's classified information. I said, well, what should I do? He says, well, sir, if I was you, I'd head for Norfolk, Virginia. Well, it was, that's where it was.
So it was classified, but not that classified.
No.
And some of the work that you would end up doing was highly classified and secret and certainly silent. That's why they call it the silent service. But you rose, and I gloss over this only because we don't have all the time in the world, but you go all the way from 1945 and discharged in 46, you're still an enlisted man on a submarine, and 15 years later, you're the commander of a nuclear submarine.
No, Paul.
It wasn't a nuclear submarine.
But it was a brand new diesel-electric submarine and a missile shooter.
Right, and had nuclear missiles,
yes,
but it wasn't powered by nuclear power.
It had nuclear missiles.
Right, a nuclear-armed submarine.
Yes.
So in 15 years, you went from enlisted man serving on a submarine to the commander of a submarine. Do you know of anyone else who's ever done that?
I don't personally, but I'm sure somebody has. I mean,
I don't know. It's a pretty rare story. You had to be in the right place at the right time, and you were. We need to catch our last commercial break, but when we come back, we're going to talk to Bob about some of those days as a commander. One of the submarines that he was on, a submarine that he commanded, is now on display in New York City at the Intrepid Air and Space Museum. We'll talk about that and what he did during the Cold War, some pretty sensitive stuff. Hopefully he'll tell us a little bit more about some of the projects he's involved in now over in Clovis with the class cataloging veterans' experiences. That's what we try to do here on Hometown Heroes, and we'll be right back here on Newstalk 580 KMJ. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. As always, the time has gone by way too quickly. It always does, especially when you've got a guest like Bob Owens, whose story is so remarkable and has so many facets to try to cover. You've heard Bob talk about how he entered the Navy during World War II, enlisting in 1943, serving as an electrician aboard a submarine in the Pacific during World War II, got out of the Navy, went to college, got a degree, got back into the Navy as an officer, ended up as a submarine commander, and that's during the 1960s, the height of the Cold War. And Bob, you had to take many a trip to that tourist spot known as the Bering Sea. And what kind of things were you doing up there?
Well, what we were doing, I was executive officer and commanding officer of a Regulus missile submarine. These are diesel-electric submarines specifically built to carry and launch Regulus nuclear missiles. Our area was off Kamchatka up in the Bering Sea, which is probably about the worst part of the Pacific Ocean you could ever go. And our time was, we would be gone from home port for 90 days. It took us a week to get to station, or 2 weeks to get to station. We were on station for 2 months and 2 weeks to get home, so that's 3 months.
And during that time?
During that time, we had to stay alert. We had to maintain radio vigilance, and I stayed submerged all the time. And to charge battery stuff, we did what they call snorkeling. But we were submerged all that time.
And you're carrying, really, I mean, this is one of those situations, it's not an exaggeration to say you're carrying the weight of the world on your shoulders, because on your submarine, you have the firepower that really could bring on the end of the world. I mean, that's what Khrushchev and Kennedy were dealing with, and after them, the leaders that followed, and you would have been the guy to pull the trigger on bombing of Russia.
That's correct. And our sister ship, the Greyback, was on station during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And they were on full alert for 14 days straight. Mm. And the missiles had all been prepped, ready to shoot. And we practiced and practiced and practiced, and we had to surface to launch our missiles. And we got it down to where we could surface, shoot the missile, and dive in 10 minutes. Mm. And which is pretty good, but if you stop and think about it, maybe you might get the second one off, but
they're coming for
you. They're coming for you.
Well, you know, at that point, it's all over anyway.
It's all over, yeah.
How did that weigh on you? I can't imagine that wouldn't affect you.
Oh, yeah, we all, that was in our mind all the time. If we had to shoot those things, it was going to be a horrible mess.
And here you are, 90 days silence, you having no contact whatsoever with your families, and in a situation like that, you have to figure you're never going to see your family again.
That's right, but who knows, we might not have had a family anyway, because if they shot back, Pearl Harbor, where I was stationed, would have been a prime target, so...
That's true. Speaking of having no contact with your family for 90 days at a time, for all of those missions in the silent service, anyone particular you want to wish a happy Valentine's Day to today?
Yes, I'd like to wish a happy Valentine's Day to my wife, Catherine. She put up with an awful lot during these times, particularly these missile cruises, where she was the dad, mother, in charge of everything.
And this June, you'll celebrate your
60th anniversary.
Congratulations on that. That's fantastic. So here you are in the Bering Sea for all of those missions. You're watching history unfold in front of your eyes. You get done with your submarine duty, and you go to work at the Pentagon. And that was some pretty interesting work, too. Instead of being in the sea prepared to fire those nuclear missiles, here you are negotiating with the Russians to try to keep both of you from launching your nuclear missiles.
Right, and try to get rid of them. I was sent to the Joint Chiefs of Staff Office for Strategic Arms Limitation, SALT, talks. And as such, I was the submarine guy in that office. So I dealt with Russian submarine captain, and they always played one up. I mean, I was a commander, so they had a captain. My boss was a lieutenant general, so they had a one star higher than that. But that's all right. But anyway, the deal was to try to stop the proliferation of nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. And that was pretty interesting, too. I know one time you went to a meeting, and I guess at some level you expect everybody to know who you are. But you got an interesting greeting from your Russian counterpart.
Yeah, I was being introduced as a member of the staff, and the ambassador introduced me as Mr. Owens because we could not wear uniforms. The Russian ambassador said, "Wait a minute, what's a submarine captain doing here?" Well, things kind of fell apart for a little minute.
And you realize, yeah, their intelligence is pretty good.
Oh, they're excellent, excellent.
When you look back, what is your sentiment about all your years in the Navy, such a variety of experiences from World War II as an enlisted man to here you are commanding a submarine with nuclear capability that could have brought on the end of the world, to then dealing in these SALT talks to try to reduce that proliferation of nuclear weapons? Is there one thing that you're most proud of? I mean, how do you sum it up when you look back at all that?
Well, I like to sum it up as I think the Navy is a great place. I enjoyed it immensely, particularly the submarine force. It's a heck of a great group of people, and I was pleased. I always had good jobs, and I could recommend the Navy to everybody. In fact, my granddaughter is graduating on the 12th of June as an ensign, and immediately leaves for Pensacola for flight school. She wants to fly an F-18 for some reason.
She doesn't want to be under the water like
no,
you.
No, absolutely not.
She must have heard all your stories, especially from World War II. Well, Bob, I know that you were featured in the book, Stories of Service, Valley Veterans Remember World War II. Janice Stevens spearheaded that effort. That book's available online from any of the major booksellers and published by Linden Publishing here in Fresno. The same folks who published my book on the Bulldog baseball team, so I can vouch for their authenticity and sincerity and general good-naturedness. You're featured in that book because you're a regular participant in Janice's class at Clovis Adult School. You meet every Monday morning?
We meet every Monday morning at 9:30 till 11:30, 12, and it's a great group of people, male and female, and some of the stories are really tremendous. You can't believe it. And right now, we're putting together the next book, follow-on book, basically a little bit left over from World War II, but Korea is the main theme, and maybe a touch on Vietnam. And she's got a lot of information already on that and putting it together, and it'll be going to the publisher sometime soon, I hope.
And you see a lot of the same faces every week, but some new faces show up too. Do you get the general sense that everyone who goes there, they're all veterans and sharing their stories with each other? Does that seem like a cathartic deal to you for a lot of the folks who participate?
Oh, I definitely think that it is, because you get there, you can share your experiences, and pretty soon you got somebody else that has one like it or maybe a little better. But some of these people have some real hair-raising stories.
Well, you've got a few yourself. And we just heard a few of them. Not all of them, but we heard a few of them, and we're very thrilled about that. Bob, we're running out of time here, but thank you so much for being on the program. Thank you for your service to our country for all of those years and for what you continue to do. I know you're very proud of your granddaughter, and we thank her for continuing that family legacy of service in the United States Navy. We're out of time for today. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next Saturday with another edition of Hometown Heroes. Remember, you can check up past programs online at KMJ580.com. Thanks for listening today here on News Talk 580 KMJ.